Tonight, for our second study of the Vilna Gaon, we are going to do something that has a very different tone to it than the first presentation. And the first year, we talked a lot about the Vilna Gaon's personality and the personality that came about from firsthand accounts of the way that he lived his life, the way that he spoke to people. And in particular, we put an emphasis on some of his regimen in the winter months, in the summer months, and the sleep. And as I said from the very beginning, it's very difficult to separate oneself from the personal account of who he was once you get a sense of who we're talking about, because his personality is so extreme and his mannerisms were so unique and his code of conduct. It's no surprise that they referred to him as a chassid, because in their mind, he was such an extreme figure. If one takes those stories at face value, even if we take half of that account at face value, it's very difficult to separate the legend of who the Vilna Gaon was and his conduct from everything else about him. So a number of people commented to me about their first impression of who he was based on those accounts, and it's not surprising at all. This is a big piece of who the Vilna Gaon was. So the second question to ask about the Gra is a much more technical one, but it's equally as important and very significant for the halachic expectations of the world we live in. So it's a little bit more technical, but it's a very big question about Judaism in general, because as we'll see, the Vilna Gaon is the exception to one of the most important principles and rules in all of Jewish law throughout Jewish history. Here's the question I want to talk about. What does it take to become a halachic authority? Lots of rabbis throughout Jewish history have had opinions. Lots of Jews throughout history have had opinions. Some of those opinions are better than others. But what makes something halachically valid? What makes a halachic position memorable? So, okay, well, let's take some hands. Yaniv. Authoritative. Yeah. Two people have two opinions in this room. Which of those opinions will be remembered for all of history? Which will be binding? Benny? Okay, so you got to be a scholar or your opinion's not worth anything. Okay, that's harsh but fair. Jay or Sharon, whoever wants to go first. People choose to follow it is very important. Right. When we studied about the Maharal last year, one of the things was very interesting. Hundreds of years, nobody read anything that the Maharal wrote. So he didn't have the right circumstances to be heard and well-respected. Sometimes it is about time and place, the right person in the right place with the right audience, with the right Talmidim, and all of a sudden things start to magnify. What are the limitations on halachic authority? Let's say someone is really, really, really intelligent. Let's say someone's a genius. Let's say it's the smartest person you've ever met. So are they free to speculate about anything and everything in Judaism and make their own? What are the limitations on that? Sandra. Oh, okay, great. Great. So sometimes a very charismatic or intelligent religious figure will overstep on something, whether it be halacha, whether it be minhag, whether it be Jewish philosophy, and it could go from being a really brilliant person to someone who's doing an avera. It could go from someone who's a great Jewish philosopher to a heretic, just like that. There are certainly lines you could cross which would jeopardize one's authority, right? There are cases of that going all the way back to the Torah's warnings about a Navi Sheker. He's got the greatest prophetic capacity of his time. As soon as he crosses the line, it's over. And that was a prediction that would come true many times throughout Jewish history. So the Shabtai is a great example for another time of a different kind. It's more about a dynamic personality than a brilliant one, but for another time. So what we're going to do tonight is ask a very specific question about the Vilna Gaon, but it opens up a very different kind of conversation about halachic authority in general, which is what is the value, the authority of the Bior Hagra? The Vilna Gaon has a collection of notes that were published many years after he died that are found on every volume, on every page of the Shulchan Aruch. And the Vilna Gaon has lots of opinions, but he has opinions that were thought about and notes taken on in the 1770s and the 1780s. How valuable are those opinions? Certain places you go to this day, more than any rabbinic figure over the last number of centuries, will say, I do that, that's Minhag HaGra, that's the Gra's position, more than anybody else. How valuable is the Gra's halachic position, and why is it as valuable as it is? That's a question that I want to try and get at today. And I think it actually tells us a great deal, not about who he was, but about the way that his Talmidim chose to enforce and impose the halachic positions of their Rebbe, which is a once in Jewish history kind of experience. So if you look on the second page of the handout, you'll see two interesting photocopies from page 124 and 127 of Eliyahu Stern's book, which I mentioned last week. And I thought for those who are not so familiar with the Bior HaGra, this might be a helpful introduction to the Vilna Gaon's commentary on Shulchan Aruch, okay? He says on page 124, the style of Elijah's commentary is unique in three respects. It's economy of language, which means that the Gra doesn't even write in full sentences, okay? They're just little notes. It's sharp clarity of conception, and it's profound originality. So the Gra will tell you three or four words in which he disagrees with everything that came before him. It's obvious what he's saying. It only takes him a few words to say it, and he has no shame in disagreeing. His frugality of language reveals more than a crib nature of note-taking. It conveys his masterful control over his predecessors and his exacting mode of expression. Elijah himself thought that there were two styles of writing, an explanatory style, which is verbose and used to express ideas to the masses, and a visionary style. Elijah privileged the visionary style, claiming that it was the one adopted by the knowledgeable and wise. For the intellectual elite, linguistic verbosity leads the reader astray and is a stumbling block. My father would love this quote if he was in the room. It means that really long, flowery essays about things are a waste of time. Just tell me your opinion and I'll take it or not. If only down to the bottom line, three or four words, you can tell you everything he needs. If you only go and writes this in Mishle and in other places as well, in his commentaries on Tanakh, he said all these elaborate descriptions of things are just distracting. Just tell me what you mean. And in Shulchan Aruch, that's exactly what he does. The stylistics of Elijah's commentary reflects his privileging of an elite visionary approach. In his commentary to Karo's Code, Elijah distills the arguments of Isserles and Maimonides. He explicates their positions in just three or four words and marshals the very sources they employed to render a new reading. This is what Rashi says. This is what the Rambam says. This is why they're wrong. Elijah's reading of the tradition is expressed with unrivaled certainty and clarity. He is undoubtedly the strongest commentator in the annals of rabbinic history, so strong that only codifiers such as Maimonides and Cairo compete with his clarity of conception and certainty of position. Now, Eliyahu Stern is just a modern guy writing a book at Yale. We could debate whether he's right or wrong, but that's a very strong statement. Okay, he's certainly entitled to his opinion. He is quite the expert, but that's his opinion, that there's no one in Jewish history who shares the clarity of conception and certainty of position like Rav Yosef Cairo, like the Rambam and the Vilna Gaon. That is good company to be in. Unlike a code, a commentary bears the burden of interpreting myriad texts and ideas and of assembling background information. Too much information, the reader grows tired. Too little, and the reader may be left puzzled. Elijah's commentaries never tease with the rhetorical questions, tip over the weighty introductions, tire readers with background texts, or test one's patience. He just says it like he believes it, as brief as possible. On page 127, he says something else which is important for historical context. Elijah was far from the first to connect Talmudic sources to the Shulchan Aruch. In other words, when you look at Bir HaGra and Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch tells you halacha, and it doesn't tell you where he got it. 90% of the things that are found in Shulchan Aruch are explicit in the Gemara. The Gemara has two different opinions, and the Shulchan Aruch tells you the opinion he likes. It doesn't tell you what page it's on. That's your job. So the Vilna Gaon will tell you, this is a source, but you should also see this source, and this source. These are the ones that are missing. What's important is that the 17th century Lithuanian rabbi Moses Rifkis, author of the Bir HaGola and Elijah's ancestor, he was the Vilna Gaon's grandfather on his mother's side of the family, made such an undertaking his life's work. The Bir HaGola, where will you find it? Where? And Gemara? And it tells you exactly where you find stuff in the Shulchan Aruch, where you find them in the Gemara. But family ties were about the only things the two scholars share. Rifkis cites only the sources used by the Shulchan Aruch, which he found in Cairo's other work, the Beis Yosef. In other words, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't tell you where things are. If you look in the Bir HaGola, he will tell you where in the Gemara they can be found. Elijah, by contrast, wants to show the Talmudic basis for every law and textually justifiable custom. As Moshe Petrover explains, Grau was not content with simply presenting the sources of laws to which he agreed with the Shulchan Aruch and Rama. Rather, he reveals the sources to the places he disagrees with them, meaning Cairo and Israel. So if you look in the Bir HaGra, most of what you will get is just citations. Citations of Bavli, citations of Yerushalmi, citations of Tosefta, citations of Medrash, primary sources. So either you're wondering, why does the Shulchan Aruch say this? It doesn't make any sense. That's not what the Gemara says in Ksubis. So then the Gra will say, see the Yerushalmi. Or the Shulchan Aruch will paskin, like what the Gemara says in the Bavli, Maseches Gittin. He'll say, oh, you have to see the Yerushalmi, Maseches Megillah, and then you'll know the Shulchan Aruch is wrong. But usually, not always, but usually, it is a reference to other primary sources that either help clarify or contradict that which appears in Shulchan Aruch. What makes it unique is that the Vilna Gaon is not just trying to show you where the Shulchan Aruch got his opinions from, but if Rav Yosef Karo is missing sources that the Gra thinks are egregiously absent, so he will tell you you have to look somewhere else if you want to know the full picture, which is pretty amazing. So here's an interesting question, which I'm only asking in reverse order because I know the answer. Why, if the Vilna Gaon probably believed that the Shulchan Aruch was not good enough, which is why he wrote the Bior or took his notes in the way that he took them, why didn't he write a Shulchan Aruch of his own? What's the reason?
He doesn't believe
that. That's an interesting possibility. Any other suggestions? Jeff says he doesn't believe in the idea of what? Right, so if you're as brilliant as the Vilna Gaon, so then it's all obvious because you already had it. Okay, so that's one possibility. Yeah? Oh, great. Okay, I understand. So Binyamin is saying something that I think is very, very nice, which is the Vilna Gaon thinks the Shulchan Aruch is pretty good, and with a few amendations here and there, it could work. So I'll just add plus or minus. Sometimes the Shulchan Aruch is wrong. Most of the time, he's probably right. I think even the Vilna Gaon would agree to that. So commentary is the fastest route to success. Donald.
Just to say differently, if he has one or two or three comments on any page, and his whole thing is just to use three or four words, he's not going to write 400 words.
Right. Now, mind you, the Vilna Gaon wrote. So he probably could have done it. But it was not his life's mission. The students of the Gra describe this crazy celebration, very spooky, mystical siyum that the Vilna Gaon conducted when he finished his commentary on Shir HaShirim. Maybe we'll look at it. We'll look at the text together another time. That was something that was very important to him. And I think he felt that he had mastered Shir HaShirim. And when he wrote it the way that he wanted it, Shir HaShirim was now complete. And he closed all the windows and he turned out all the lights, and it was a very spooky kind of thing. But on Jewish law, he didn't do that. So yeah, last one. Go ahead.
Wasn't Shulchan Aruch and the law already accepted by them much earlier?
Okay, so you're getting yourself into trouble, and I appreciate that. So what? So no one was offended until Michael had the courage to say, "How dare you insinuate that the Vilna Gaon would replace the code of Jewish law with a better code of Jewish law?" When was the Shulchan Aruch published? Late 1500s. Rav Yosef Karo died when? 1579, something like that. Late 1570s, I think. Rav Yosef Karo passed away. The Rama lived a little bit longer. Okay, so by 1600, you have a Shulchan Aruch and a Rama. Okay, when is the Bir HaGra, when is the Vilna Gaon taking his notes? Because they don't get published. So volume at a time, 1830s, 1860s, whatever. So late 18th century, 200 years after. And as we talked about in other occasions, the Shulchan Aruch had the perfect timing, right? Code of Jewish Law is written by Rav Yosef Karo as the printing press becomes normative, which means everybody has a Shulchan Aruch and a Rama. It's the number one book every Jew has to have. And that's why it completely eclipses everything else in the Jewish library, because not only is it good, not only does it support basically Sephardim and Ashkenazim, but it's accessible and affordable for the first time in Jewish history. Rav Yosef Karo is the star. And it's fair to say, with some exception, which is what we're talking about right now, once Rav Yosef Karo codified Jewish law, it surpasses the Gemara in terms of its halachic significance. Because you can have all the opinions you want in the world, but that's not how the Shulchan Aruch Paskin. Jeff disagrees, right? So who disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch and when is a very touchy subject, because everybody seems to agree by the 1700s that this is the code of Jewish law. This has become, Shulchan Aruch has become a primary text of Jewish tradition, and arguing with it is a very sensitive subject. Now, with all these excellent suggestions being made, what did the Vilna Gaon actually say? Because the Vilna Gaon was asked this question. In the introduction to Shulchan Aruch, which we saw some of last week, we'll keep referring back to them because these biographical notes are so important. In the introduction to the Shulchan Aruch, which was written by, the two sons of the Vilna Gaon, you have this tiny, tiny text. Only if you merit to read a candlelight with excellent vision, can you read it along with me? I had no idea what size they would be when they printed. Okay, in the top right corner of this second page. Now, the children, just to explain what's happening, I love the people are turning on their cell phone lights to see this. The Gruz children write that the reason that he turned out, that the Vilna Gaon closed the windows during the day and read by candlelight, because when like the Gemara says about Bedikas Chametz, so you can only see what's right in front of you. He didn't want to get distracted. We should do that one week. We'll turn out the lights. Everyone can bring a candle and we'll see who can read the source sheet. That would be amazing. Okay, it wouldn't go very well. We'd get sued by whoever falls. It wouldn't be great. So the children of the Vilna Gaon are trying to explain in this context that everything their father did was a success. Why is everything that their father did a success? Because he's the best. Because he's the smartest person, he's the holiest person, and he's the hardest working person anyone ever met. Right? We saw that last week. That's exactly how nobody outworked the Vilna Gaon. Nobody was smarter than the Vilna Gaon, and no one was more pious than the Vilna Gaon. If you have that trifecta, you're the greatest figure in Jewish history. So anything that the Vilna Gaon did not achieve, you're left wondering, well, he worked harder than everyone else. He's smarter than everyone else. He's holier than everyone else. Why was he not successful? How many things did the Vilna Gaon not achieve in his life? I call it 2.5. Hopefully by the time we're done, we'll get to 2.5. So look at this paragraph. Rov pikhuso vishtaluso bavodas Hashem. Just to give you a sense of how our fathers wisdom and effort. He sha'amdalo neged ko me'iklo. Nothing interfered with my father's goals. V'hi sha'hisir kol da'aga v'chol etzer. No emotional distraction, no anxiety, no worry. La'avodas Hashem b'simcha b'tov lev kol hayom. He did exactly what Hashem wanted from him all the time. V'chol yom v'yom nis'atzma b'yadu ha'skola ha'amitis. And every single day, because he had complete control over his own emotional and psychological self, he never had a bad day, right? He was always 100%. Ad shehiskimo Imo das kono, which is a remarkable theological statement, which means basically Hashem let my father have whatever he wanted, right? That's what it means. Below asa midaito kitano gedola. And he never veered from what Hashem wanted from him, big or small. Shtayim zu shamati mipi b'kodesh ha'tahor. Shelo eskima imo das kono below us. There are only two things that I heard from my father's holy mouth that he wanted to achieve and Hashem did not allow him to. Le'ezik naso, at the end of his life, when my father was older, sha'altiv pamim rabos. I started to ask him many times. We do this with our older relatives. We have important questions about their lives that we didn't have the courage to ask, and we realized that we're going to run out of opportunities to ask them. So I got up the courage to ask my father, madua lo nasa la'eretz ha'kedosha. Why didn't you make aliyah? Remember we talked about that last week? Because he left. He said, I'm going to Israel. And then he came back. He didn't tell anybody why not. We still have to answer that question. Velo anani. He didn't tell me. Pam achas hivsarti bo harbe. I started to harass my father. I really, like, tell me the answer. I'm your son. I'm entitled to know. Veheshivani ein li reshus min hashamayim. Hashem did not allow me to make aliyah. V'chein hivtiach li sheyaseh piske halachos mi'arba turim b'deya machra'as. My father told me at some point that he was going to write a code based on the tour, not based on what everybody, Jeff, figured it out, not based on the Shulchan Aruch, such a contemporary book. He's going to write a code based on the tour, Bidea Machra'as, Lichtov Rak Dea Achas Hayishara Binyane Chachmaso. Now, he was going to write only one opinion. Isn't the Shulchan Aruch just one opinion? Samson says there's two opinions. Whose opinions are it? See, already, by the time you get to the Vilna Gaon, there's already two solid official opinions, Ashkenazic and Sephardic. So my father, what? And every, the Yeshom, sometimes the Shulchan Aruch gives you two opinions, so you have to know that I follow the first opinion, second opinion. And he said, oh, my father was going to do it the right way. One opinion, Dea Achas HaYeshara Binyane Chachmaso, Birayos Chazakos Vatsumos, She'ein lahashiv aleihem. He was going to write one book with all the rules, with all the proofs that will be irrefutable. Bikashtiv kama shanim lefnei petiraso. So I said to him, Dad, what happened to the book? Right? Imagine if he would have written this, what would have been in Jewish history? Beheshiv li pamachas, ein li rishus min hashamayim. Amarti roi haya. I said to myself, meaning I think this is this father saying to the son, I told myself, Ru'uya Haisa, this would be a great project. Ella She'ein Hador Nira Yafet. Halo Hashem Zucha Tanula. What does the Vilna Gaon mean when he says, Ein Li Rishus Min Hashamayim? That is a really good question. Sometimes you ask people, why did your business close? Or why did that relationship not work out? And they say, it was meant to be, right? It's the way God wanted it. What does the Vilna Gaon mean? How do his children understand the very few things in their lives that they saw their father incapable of doing? And it sounds like they understood it to be even more than that, that there's something mysterious happening here. The Vilna Gaon believed that he could write a code of Jewish law that would far surpass that of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. It would be one opinion. It would fix all of the mistakes. This is a big theme in his writing. The Vilna Gaon is trying to fix all the errors of scholarly Jewish history with one person, but Hashem didn't want him to. Hashem didn't want him in Israel. Hashem wanted him in Vilna. Hashem didn't want him to write a code, so he just left notes, corrections of an existing one. In Elio Stern's book, he has a line that I thought was really curious with a footnote. And I looked in the back, look in the footnotes. And in the footnotes, he says that one of his friends told him that he was talking to Rav Baruch Simon at Yeshiva University. So this is it was an interesting note to find in the book. And Rav Simon told him, you should look at this comment of the Bir Hagra, which I have on the right side of the second page. I was so excited that he quoted Rabbi Simon. And then I saw it in the Bir Hagra and I understood it. It's a very complicated sugya, which we're not doing right now, in which the Shulchan Aruch is talking about animals and shechting animals on Yontif for cooking, first day of Yontif, second day of Yontif, animals that are inside the Tchum and outside the Tchum, it's not our sukkah. But the Bi'ur HaGra, in responding to the Shulchan Aruch's opinion, which in this case he does not like, you can see it here, it's like a little bit of a sample. So he quotes the Shach, he quotes the Rashba, he quotes the Mishnah, he quotes Rashi, this all happens in a couple of lines. And then you see it, it's the end of Sif Katan Tesvav, and he basically proves to you that he knows what the Shulchan Aruch is talking about. He's not sure if the Shulchan Aruch is right, because the Shulchan Aruch says things in other places that contradicts himself. And then he writes, Va'af, in the underlined section, Va'af Sha Shulchan Aruch Soser, if you're reading it here and you remember what the Shulchan Aruch wrote over there, he's clearly contradicting himself. It has to be one of the greatest lines in all of the Bi'ur HaGra. The fact that he contradicts himself, everybody knows he contradicts himself. Like you read the Shulchan Aruch, you see all the flaws. At least the Vilna Gaon did, which is really a remarkable statement. That this person saw the Shulchan Aruch with all of its flaws. He is not writing an affectionate commentary. I would say it is reverent of the Shulchan Aruch, but it is not affectionate because he sees all of the things in the Shulchan Aruch that are missing. He sees all the things in the Shulchan Aruch that are contradictory. And he wants you to know that you can't just read this book, which is a very strong statement on the Shulchan Aruch. You can't just read it. He's not going to explain it all to you. He's going to do his best to tell you that if you only learn this sugya and you never learn the Tosefta, you have no idea what's going on. If you only look at it here and you don't look over there, you'll never realize that the Shulchan Aruch is contradicting himself. And that is a very strong statement 200 years after the Shulchan Aruch has become normative. Yeah. Not that I know of. Right. So he's an equal opportunity offender when it comes to the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. And for these purposes, we're talking about them somewhat, just the book as a whole with the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah basically as one. So I wanted to give you a couple of interesting examples. I'll give you an example of this was one that I saw that I thought was great. Okay. This is, you have one page in the top left corner of the next page. This is the sefer called Maaseh Rav, which is recorded practices of the Vilna Gaon, which was originally written shorthand. Like if you have, I have great rebbeim in my life. And if I were smart enough, I would write down everything I saw them do that was interesting. And if I saw them do something that was interesting, I'd have the chutzpah to ask them why they do that. And if you wrote them all down, you basically have a halacha sefer from a walking living person. So we have many of these in Jewish history. One of the classics is Maaseh Rav, which is students of the Vilna Gaon. Again, he has very few students that wrote down the things that he did or the halachic positions that he held. So here's a really great example. When you hang a mezuzah on a door, the examples I'm going to give you tonight are not life-shattering examples, but they accentuate the point we need them to accentuate. When you hang a mezuzah on a door, what direction is the mezuzah supposed to be affixed to the door? Thank you very much. Okay, so we have a machlokas, a famous machlokas between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, his grandson, right? Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi's position is that when you hang a mezuzah on a door, how should the mezuzah be hung? Straight up. Straight up. Rabbi Natab's position is that when a mezuzah is hung on a door, how should the mezuzah be hung? Horizontal. Rashi is the vertical position. Rabbi Natab, everyone's going, wait a second. That neither of those is what I do in my house. Give me a second. Rashi says this way, and Rabbi Natab says this way. Now, it's 1 year on Shavuos. It's such a great Shavuos topic. We'll do all the Rabbeinu Tams, wherever Rabbeinu Tam talks, because Rabbeinu Tam's position, all of the Rabbeinu Tams about this topic alone, because they're super interesting. Rabbeinu Tam writes about it all over the place. And just to give you a preview of that shiur, which we may or may not ever do together, this is the position of Rabbeinu Tam. What is the respectful way for a scroll to be placed? On its back, laid down. You don't leave stuff like this, right? If you have a valuable painting, you don't put it on the floor. And you know, some people do that. They come to shul and they put their sitter on the shtender and they let go. And then the middle shmoneh esrei falls off. People do that. If you have a book that's open that you value, you don't put it like this because then it falls over. You put it flat on its back. Rabbeinu Tam is of the position that all scrolls should be laid down, open or closed. If we followed Rabbeinu Tam's position, the Aron Kodesh and Shul would not have Sifrei Torah standing up. Rabbeinu Tam thinks all the Sifrei Torah should be laid down. When you carry a Sefer Torah around the room after you do Psicha, everyone has to stand up because the Sefer Torah is not in its place of rest. When the Sefer Torah gets put onto the Shulchan, everyone can sit down. So Rabbeinu Tam says when you put them away, they should be flat. When you hang a mezuzah on the door, the mezuzah should be flat. He disagrees with Rashi. So Rashi's position, this way. Rabbeinu Tam's position, this way. Okay? Shulchan Aruch says, when you hang a mezuzah, you should? He says, you should? You should do it this way. Rama says, really? You should do it this way. But the minhag ha'olam is to compromise. Why? The only place in Jewish history we compromise with each other is mezuzah, is another discussion. That's a great question, okay? But we should compromise. Rama says, that's our position. We compromise, we put the mezuzah on an angle, and everybody's happy. So the Vilna Gaon says, no, you're wrong, right? Rashi's right, the mezuzah should be straight. So everybody else follows the position of the Rama, that the mezuzah should be slanted. Or maybe you're Sephardic. Ashkenazic Jews follow the Rama's position. So the Vilna Gaon says, no, he's wrong. He just says, as a matter of fact, that's not the Vilna Gaon's position. He thinks the Rama was wrong. He said that's the minhag. He's not correct. The mezuzah should be straight up. We should follow the position of Rashi. So most Svardim follow the practice of doing it straight. I saw this a tshuva from Rav Avadia. When people have roommates and they're trying to figure one roommate is Ashkenazic and the other one is Sephardic, you can guess how Rav Avadia concludes his position, but that's for another time. So here's a really interesting other example of the Vilna Gaon's position, but this one will get us back into the biographical elements of who the Vilna Gaon was and what his intentions were. So bear with me, because this one also can get a little bit confusing. Okay, everyone makes Havdalah at home on Motzei Shabbos, right? How many people make Havdalah standing? How many people sit when they make Havdalah? How many sitter? Ooh, okay, I that's more than I expected. Okay, that's great. So we've got like an 80-20 split in the room, okay, on this issue. So if you look in the Maaser Rav, top left corner of that next page, Sif Kuf Nun. Okay, everyone see it? Top left corner on that page, on the third page in the Maaser Rav section, Havdalah Miyushav. What is it? It's a testimony that if I heard the Vilna Gaon make Havdalah, you went to his house for Havdalah after Shul, he sat down and he made Havdalah. But what's a halacha? So it's a machlokes, right? So we kiddish, some people, we're not going to talk about, you know, some Friday nights, some people stand, Shabbos day, people sit, some people only sit, some people only stand. So what's a halacha about Havdalah? Is Havdalah, well, it's Mori Priyakafen, so maybe it's B'makom Suda, but there's no food, but it's a kvias, so there's lots of people. Do you draw a distinction between making Havdalah for yourself versus making Havdalah for others? Well, lots of different opinions. Vilna Gaon, Maaser Rav, what did the Vilna Gaon do? He sat during Havdalah. That's his position. So all those who sit during Havdalah, you're in the right shir. Now, there is a book, a very important book, if you want to really study the life of the Vilna Gaon, so you have to read Alios Eliyahu. Alios Eliyahu was written by Yoshua Heschel Levine. Yoshua Heschel Levine was, I may get the exact details of this wrong, so don't hold me to it, but I believe was married to Rav Chaim Volozhiner's granddaughter. He lived in Volozhin. He was a descendant of this kind of culture, the Vilna Gaon's Talmidim. He was married into the family, and in the second generation Machlokas that tore Volozhin apart, he was one of its prominent figures, for those who know anything about the history of the Lashon. So Alios Eliyahu was his attempt to record some biographical and halachic pieces about the Vilna Gaon's life. And in this section, which is very hard to read in the middle of this next page, you see the cover page of Alios Eliyahu, and then you see a paragraph from it underneath. V'chein le'inyin ma'ashekastev ba'orachayim havdalah miyusha. If you look in the halachos in Shulchan Aruch, it's the Vilna Gaon's position that havdalah should be said, recited, while sitting. Sipra li'yedidi harav hagon hayashish Rav Tzvi Hirsch, I'm not sure who this is, based in from the town of Otan. I don't know where that is either. Asher ra be'inav es hagon Rav Chaim v'lashon Zatzal, k'she hivdil b'motzei Shabbos Kodesh hivdil me'umat. Rav Chaim Velazhner, by all accounts, is the preeminent student of the Vilna Gaon. He is the Vilna Gaon's most important, most famous, most scholarly rabbinic successor, Rosh Yeshiva Velazhner. When you enter Rav Chaim Velazhner's house for Havdalah on Motzei Shabbos, did he sit or stand? He stood. What's the problem? The Vilna Gaon said. Now, if you're a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, you do what the Vilna Gaon said, right? Oh, okay, great. Hold that thought. Below here at Benafsho Lishalo. So Rav Tzvi Hirsch, whoever he is, was at the Vilna Gaon's house, or in Shul, whatever. The Vilna Gaon, the Chaim Velazhner's house. Rav Chaim Velazhner made Havdalah standing up. So what do you want to say? Hey, Vilna Gaon, you're supposed to be sitting. But it's a chutzpah. You can't say that to Rav Chaim Velazhner. Halo hagra bibiuro kasev to Havdalah miyusha. So, okay, kiem sibib hadavar pam achas. But then the following circumstances made themselves available. Asher hagaon marin Rav Chaim ra'u so lomi b'shulchan aruch shel hagaon. One time Rav Chaim Velazhner was walking through the yeshiva and he noticed that Tzvi Hirsch was learning the shulchan aruch shel hagaon. What's shulchan aruch shel hagaon? So what's the Vilna Gaon shulchan aruch? He didn't write a shulchan aruch. So why didn't he say that? What does it mean? So it's one interesting historical thing to appreciate. When the Vilna Gaon students started publishing the Bi'ur HaGra, so what did they publish? The Shulchan Aruch with the Bi'ur HaGra. What else was on the page? Nothing. What about the Shach and the Taz? Who needs those things? We don't need them anymore because every comment you need, our Revi already put there. He told us every single comment you need is already on the page. They got into huge trouble because they start selling Shulchan Aruch. And you know, nowadays you get a Shulchan Aruch, it has 65 commentaries on every page. In the Tanya, you only get 4 words of Shulchan Aruch on every page because it has a this and a that and a Peskei Tshuvos, so all these Svarim you have to have. And the Beis Hillel, all you have to have everything, right? So they were selling Mechaber Gra. That's it, because that's their opinion. Sound familiar, right? Maimonides, once you have my book, you don't need anything else. It never goes well in Jewish history. So that's what it means, right? One of the Talmidim is sitting in Velazhen, studying from Shulchan Aruch with Gra. And the Chaim Velazhner walks by, the Shep Samnachas. You know, nowadays people learn Shulchan Aruch Mishnah Brura. Back then they were learning Shulchan Aruch and Gra. V'yisbonin ha'gom marin Rav Chaim v'yomar ilah. Rav Chaim Velazhner starts up a conversation with this student and he says, ki hagon es biuro kasav, it is true that our Rebbe did write these notes. Ach la'atzmo lizkor kol hashitos u'mekor hadinim. Why did he write them down? So that he, because he took notes on everything, the Gra, he had no intention of publishing them. He just wrote them down so that he would remember all of the positions that he was thinking about. What's Rav Chaim Velazhner telling this person? Sounds like it's not authoritative, which is shocking. But once Rav Chaim Velazhner says to you, you should know these are really just notes. They were not meant for publication. So now you can have a real conversation. Oh, by the way, Rebbe, Oz Pasach Pivi Omer Lagon Rav Chaim. Ra'isi, by the way, says, you know, so I was learning Shulchan Aruch with Gra. Ra'isi Shagra Posek Havdalah Miyushev. Did you know that the Vilna Gaon used to make Havdalah sit, everybody get it? You can't say to him, how dare you, but you can say, I saw the strangest thing. I thought everybody makes Havdalah standing. I've never seen anybody say Havdalah sitting. Did you know that? The Yomer lo Hagon Rav Chaim. So Rav Chaim said to him, Anochi ra'isi es hagon she'amad be'es havdalah. I was there and I saw him stand during havdalah. Jeff, gam anochi osakein. Doesn't matter what your father did. He says, why do I stand during havdalah? Because the gross stood during havdalah. One is what? Who's confused? Everyone's got the timeline here, right? Maisa Rav says the Vilna Gaon sat during Havdalah. Rav Chaim Velazhner says I stand during Havdalah because that's what the Vilna Gaon says. But I and Maisa Rav and if Lacy Asher Lo His Orer Brazeh Hagon Rav Chaim Baska Muscle Maisa Rav. So there's one more fact you need to know. If you open a Maisa Rav, this is a version I bought from like Eichler's online during the summer. This is a very modern version. On the bottom, it just has Sophia Halachos from the Shulchan Aruch for the Mishnah Berurah. It's a very modern version. There's a older, fancier commentaries. But any version of Maisa Rav has the Haskama of Rav Chaim Velazhner. You can't publish a book about the Vilna Gaon during Rav Chaim Velazhner's life unless he agrees to it. So Rav Chaim Velazhner says, thank you so much for writing down, I'm paraphrasing, all of the wonderful practices of our dear Rebbe, Hagona Chassid, Rav Eliyahu of Vilna. I enjoy the book and I think it's great for people to have, but you should know you made 9 mistakes. Mistake number 1, the Vilna Gaon did this. Mistake number 2, the Vilna Gaon did that. You said he did that. That's not true because the whole point is it's a record. So he says, I was there. Remember, the Vilna Gaon's Talmidim did not spend a lot of time with him, which means if he changed his position from decade to decade, which is possible, they had very different experiences. What's to say he had a chumrah in his early life that became a kula, or more likely a kula that eventually became a chumrah? Things can change over time. So it could be that he did, it could be that he didn't. The Bir Agra says you're supposed to sit during Havdalah. Chaim Velazhner says, I was there and he stood. And that's why I do what I do. So number 1, you have to appreciate how much effort was invested to codify every single mannerism and behavior of the Vilna Gaon. Everything he did was halachically authoritative, but it's not a perfect record. Rav Chaim Velazhner corrects Maisa Rav in many places, but he clearly missed in others because his position was that the Vilna Gaon always stood during Havdalah. And in the book, it says that he sat during Havdalah and maybe he missed it. Or maybe he got confused. I don't know, but it's not going to be perfect. Yeah, Sandra. It's very possible. I don't know. I'm just pointing out, number 1, that there is a tremendous effort on behalf of the Talmidim and the grandchildren and the descendants and the successors of the Vilna Gaon to try and write down because what he did is all that matters. And for the most part, they're probably right, but it's not 100%. It's not 100%, meaning in their attempt to record correctly what he actually did, it's not going to be a perfect record. It's just not going to be. So we see 2 very important things here in this paragraph from Rav Chaim Velazhner. Point number 1 is that in his opinion, the Bir Hagra was never meant to be published as an authoritative halachic work, which is fascinating, even though he did everything based on what the Gra told him. And number 2, there is some discrepancy about what the Gra actually did, and it's very significant. Now, I have to just take a minute, even though it's important, but it's not super important for us, but I have to take a minute to show you on the bottom of the page a citation from a tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein that you have to see. Because the person asked Rav Moshe if they should be standing during Havdalah or sitting during Havdalah based on the Vilna Gaon's position. We're not going to read the whole tshuva. It's not the whole things here on the page, but you can read it on your own. The last 3 words before the section that I underlined. B'lachin, kevan shala'asos delo kipsak harama, to veer from the Rama's position is to disobey the custom of Ashkenaz. By the way, this the Rama says, the Shulchan Aruch says you should, I don't remember the Shulchan Aruch says, the Rama says that you should stand for Havdalah. And he says, Shekein hu ha-minag, everybody stands for Havdalah. That's what the Rama says. So he says, if that's what the Rama says, that's the minag, you should do it. Shelachein, ein lecha l'shanos minhagcha u'minhag beis avicha lahavdil me'umad. See, the question was, my father stands during Havdalah. I'd like to sit like the position of the Vilna Gaon. He says, whoa, whoa, whoa. Your father stands during Havdalah. The Rama says you're supposed to stand during Havdalah. You're going to stand during Havdalah. The Adaraba, Tamual, Elu, Shashinu, Mimin Hagam, Lahavdil, Meumad, Vishilu, Lahavdil, Meushab. He says, I don't know who are these people that stop standing during Havdalah and starting to sit. Ivra, Digam, Anim, Abdil, Meushab, even though, by the way, Rav Moshe says, I sit during Havdalah. Jeff, why? Hu Mishum, Shekain, Haya, Minag, Adoni, Avi, Morini, Zal. Umimela, Gam, Banai, the Ulai. Gam harbe mitalmidai osin king. He said, my kids sit during Havdalah because I sit during Havdalah. I sit during Havdalah because my father sat during the Havdalah. And it's very likely that lots of guys who grew up on the Lower East Side probably sitting during Havdalah now also because they saw me do it. But I'll call upon him, lo dami the shard for him. Af le elu she'osin ke'agra. Kevan she'eno baror das hagra lemaisa. He says, even if you're like a grub person, and we'll try and figure out exactly what that means, even if you're a Vilna Gaon person, you can't change your minhag to sit during Havdalah if we're not even sure if the Vilna Gaon sat during Havdalah. But you see, there's a second level to this tshuva of Rav Moshe, because he's having the exact same experience as the Vilna Gaon, right? People say that they grew up in Muncie, and Rav Moshe used to visit. I'm not looking at anyone in particular. Rav Moshe used to visit, and they swear this is what Rav Moshe did when he visited us in Muncie. People on the Lower East Side say, not true, he never did that. People saw Rav Moshe in the Catskills in the summer, and they said, Rav Moshe told me X, Y, and Z. Never did that on the Lower East Side. I don't know. I was once, I think I told the story before, I was at Rav Schechter Shlita's house for Friday night dinner a bunch of years ago. I don't remember how I got there. I was at the Schechter's home for Friday night dinner, and Rav Schechter told this story that as he was pouring wine for everyone after Kiddush, so Rav Schechter said that that he heard a rumor in his name that Kiddush on Shabbos Day is supposed to be made with white wine. Have people heard me tell this story before? I think I told this story before. So Rav Schechter said, people said in my name that Kiddush is supposed to be made on white wine on Shabbos Day. So he said, I couldn't figure out. I never said that. I don't think that's correct. So I couldn't figure out what happened. So he said, then he realized what happened, which is, Rav Schechter said he doesn't buy any wine. He's a Rebbe. People bring him shalach manos. All the wine in his house is wine that people have delivered to the Schechter's home. So they don't buy wine. So they drink it. So he says, what wine are you supposed to make Kiddush on? Red wine. That's what Shulchan Aruch says. That's the Gemara says in Pesachim, that the right wine to make Kiddush on is red wine. That's the ideal wine. We had this whole discussion about Pesach on other occasions. Okay? That's the wine you're supposed to use. So what are you supposed to do if people keep bringing you bottles of white wine? You have nothing to use it for. So eventually you start using it just to get rid of it. So if Schechter said, I reasoned to myself that Kiddush Friday night is a Din D'Oraisa. Kiddush during the day is a Din D'Rabbanan. So if you're going to use the white wine for Kiddush, you should probably use it for when Kiddush is a D'Rabbanan. So I pushed it all to lunch just so I could get rid of it when Kiddush only be D'Rabbanan. And now people say, I hold, you have to use white wine. And he's just trying to get rid of it. So here you have the same thing, layer over layer over layer of the very same thing. The Rav Moshe Feinstein tells you that there are people who are changing their practice to sit for Havdalah because it says in Maaseh Rav, that's what the Vilna Gaon used to do. His own Talmidim are switching their practice to sit during Havdalah because Rav Moshe's father sat during Havdalah. He doesn't say why. Why did Rav Moshe's father sit during Havdalah? Maybe he followed the Gra. I have no idea. But even the Gra's Talmidim aren't exactly sure. If we were sure, would we switch our position to that of the Vilna Gaon? So he, Rav Moshe doesn't say you can't do it, but he said you have to at least be sure that that's what the Gra actually said, that's what he meant, that's what the Vilna Gaon wrote. How did the Vilna Gaon become this person? How did he become so authoritative that some of us say to ourselves, it doesn't matter what the Rama says in Shulchan Aruch, my family follows the Vilna Gaon. Now, there are people in Israel, we'll talk about the students of the Vilna Gaon who succeeded to make Aliyah, even though he did not. And there are people who really come from families of Yisrael of Shklov and their descendants of people who were Talmidim of the Gra who have been observing the Vilna Gaon's positions for almost 250 years. There are such people. But how did the Vilna Gaon become such a tremendous authority? This is not only my question. This is everybody's question to a certain extent. To kind of convey to you, because the two articles I'm going to show you are a little like scholarly. So for those with the neshama in the room that want to see this differently, I'll explain it to you in the firmest possible way, and then we can break it down maybe more academically. Okay? It's all the same. It's just packaging. Okay? If you look in the second to last page, you have a photocopy of the Koves Igros of the Chazon Ish. Okay? This is a very famous quote of the Chazon Ish. These are letters that the Chazon Ish wrote. They're very hard to read. They're very choppy. They don't really begin. They don't end. They don't say who they're written to. They don't always have dates on them. They're very confusing. What the Chazon Ish is talking about in this letter is the how to engage with the possibility that the primary texts of Jewish tradition have made mistakes. What if there's something wrong? What if Rashi was wrong? What if the Shulchan Aruch is wrong? What if the Gemara is not right? How do we engage with this question? How do we have emunas chachamim that the code of Jewish law is accurate, whether or not we think we find mistakes in it? Okay, and in this context, he talks about one very important principle in Jewish law, the working assumption, which we all take for granted, but is not necessarily obvious, you know, to a secular person on the street, is that there come certain points in Jewish history in which we block off anything that came before it as a certain kind of sacred, right? Anything that exists in the Chumash is by definition perfect, is 100% correct. The Mishnah has two opinions about something. There isn't a third opinion. There's only two opinions in the Mishnah, right? Can the Mishnah argue on the Chumash? Of course not, right? Then the Gemara comes along and the Gemara is having a debate about the Mishnah. What if the Gemara wants us, the Amoraim, want to say that these Tanaim had no idea what they're talking about? They're wrong. Can they do it? How do we know that to be the case? There's a rule, right? There is a working principle here that we all accept. The Torah is right and the Tanaim were working with it. The Mishnayos are correct and the Amoraim are working with it. The Gaonim came along and they decided that everything that appears in Shas is the new base level primary text with which we are, which opinion in the Gemara are we going to follow? We're going to follow one of them. The question is just which. Rishonim come along and they don't even really a little bit, but they don't really argue with the Gaonim. And then the Achronim come along in Jewish history. Oh, it's a Rishon, right? That's what the Rishonim say. We're stuck. And then to a certain extent, following the era of the Shulchan Aruch, once the Shulchan Aruch said it, he said it. Look at this amazing paragraph. Bottom of Nun Ches on that page of the Koves Igros of the Chazon Ish. Nachzer Lashitos Hagra. He says, when it comes to thinking about the halachic authority, that something enters the pantheon, the code of Jewish eternal values. Hine gam bezeh misyaches besifro bekriros yesera. Anu misyachsim lahagra bishura shel Moshe Rabbeinu alav shalom, Ezra alav shalom, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rav Ashi, HaRambam, HaGra. These are the words of the Chazon Ish, very important words. He says, here is the timeline of Jewish scholarship. This is all you need to know. Moshe Rabbeinu, Ezra Sofer, Rav Yehuda Anasi, that's the Mishnah, Rav Ashi, that's the Gemara, there's the Rambam, and there's the Vilna Gaon. That's it. That's it. Shiniskalet Torah al Yado Kikadosh Meusa Laka Sheheir Bimashlo Huar Ad Sheba Vinatal Chelko. There were things out there that no one had grasped until the Vilna Gaon, and he showed up on the scene and changed it forever. Vahu Nechshav Keechad Min HaRishonim. We treat the Vilna Gaon in 18th century Vilna as if he was the Rambam or Rashi, or the Ran, or the Rashba, or the Ritva. He's a Rishon. He has the authority of someone, that's what I wanted to call the Vilna Gaon in time travel. The Vilna Gaon has the authority of someone living 500 years before him. Who gets that? V'lachein, cholek aleihem b'kama mekomos b'tokef oz. How does we know that the Vilna Gaon has the authority to be a Rishon? This is very important. Because he treats himself like a Rishon. And I don't mean that humorously, even though maybe it's funny. The Vilna Gaon, who was essentially perfect, right, never hesitates to argue the Ran is wrong, right? The Rama says that he's not sure if Rashi is right or Rabbeinu Tam is right. Rabbeinu Tam is wrong because those are supposed to be straight. Who says that? Yeah, he says, Gamal Arif, the Rambam, We need an expert to come in and talk about the Vilna Gaon's relationship to the Rambam, who it doesn't seem like he liked very much. It's depressing to translate. His madrega in Ruach HaKodesh, his chasidus, his brilliance, his effort, his familiarity with all the texts, he has bekiyas in all of the amikos b'Torah, it is impossible to quantify the grasp of the Vilna Gaon's knowledge and the depth of his greatness. We say things about the Vilna Gaon that we don't say about anybody else. Don't wonder why the Gra argues with the Shulchan Aruch that came 200 years before him. I don't have a problem with him arguing with Rishonim that came 500 years before him. How many times does the Vilna Gaon argue with the Shulchan Aruch? The Chasun Ish says hundreds. When you study, and we're going to run out of time, and you can read some of these on your own. When you study about the Vilna Gaon, you see this really remarkable, consistent theme, which is the students of the Vilna Gaon want you to know something about their Rebbe, which is there hasn't been anyone like him in centuries. This is a consistent theme in all the biographical records that we have of the Vilna Gaon. There are a couple of them that are very prominent. One is the one that the Chazon Ish is reflecting or echoing, which is the Vilna Gaon's knowledge of Jewish law and his comfort in disagreeing with those who came before him. There's one of the English quotes in Etkes' book on that other page, but I'm worried that we're going to run out of time. There are two primary ones here that I want you to focus on. The first is in Emmanuel Etkes' book in the chapter Agona Chassid. So he talks about this also from the children's memories of their father. Rav Chaim characterized the innovations of the Gaon in his interpretation of Zrayim as such that none of the sages of the generations before us equaled them since the time the Talmud was completed. These are the kind of things that their Vilna Gaon students said about their Rebbe. Unequivocally, he was much smarter than all the Rishonim, which is really remarkable that you can get away with saying something like that. Rav Chaim Volozhiner says something that's absolutely crazy shocking, which I think we have in English of. Yeah, on the last page of the handout. Alan Nadler has an essay where he talks about this theme very effectively. It's just echoing the same thing as the Chazon Ish. I'll try and develop why it's so radical in a second. When Rav Chaim Volozhiner writes about the Vilna Gaon's commentary on Sifra Ditznusa, which we talked about last week, his commentary on the Zohar. So he says something crazy. It's either translated, the paragraph on the left column in Alan Nadler's article. On account of, this is Rav Chaim Volozhiner translated to English. On account of our many transgressions, the keen eye required for any investigation of the writings of early authorities, including the Ari of blessed memory, in order to trace them to their sources in the Zohar, the Idros and the Tikkunim have been dulled. In other words, if anyone wants to understand the relationship between what the Arizal wrote and how it connects to the Zohar, it's almost impossible to do. We live in an age of sin. People aren't so holy. You can't really understand what's going on there, except for Chaim Vital, as Luria himself had testified. In other words, Arizal said, I have one student who's qualified. His name is Chaim Vital. You can count on him. Consequently, since the Arizal's one student, no one dared enter deeply into the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh Kadashim, for the times were impoverished and the crops of the field diminished, and no one among us knew anything until God, may his name be blessed, manifested his compassion for the sake of his righteousness, and in order to raise and glorify his word and to show us wonders by means of his Torah. Behold, from the clouds there descended a man to whom great praise is due. This great man was unique, for there had not been anyone like him for many generations before him. Unto him did God bestow a heart that understands and eyes that see, right? And to him were the paths of thoroughfares of both the revealed and the hidden Torah made clear. An abundance of discernment was granted unto him. This was none other than our pious and hallowed great and holy Gaon. Rav Chaim Volozhiner, in his introduction to Sifra Ditznusa, says that Arizal was great. And he had a student named Chaim Vital, who was great. And then for hundreds of years, nothing. And then my Rebbe came along, and he's great. This is in mysticism, not in Jewish law. The Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon do this every single time. Yeah, you know, after the Rambam, there were some late Rishonim, and there were some early Achronim, and then Shulchan Aruch was okay. And then my Rebbe came along, and he really understands Gemara. Nobody really understood it for hundreds of years until the Vilna Gaon came along. Chaim Volozhiner says, you know, lots of people who study Kabbalah, but like they're not so from. They can't really internalize the messages of the Kabbalah. It's not really, you know, they could try and understand it, but how are they supposed to know if they know what the Arizal is really talking about? My Rebbe really knew what the Arizal was talking about. You should read this book. He's the only person who's known what it meant for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. There is a rule that we operate with, for better or for worse, of Yeridas Hadoros. The people of the Gemara don't argue with the Mishnah. The Gaonim don't argue with the Gemara. The Rishonim don't argue with the Gaonim. The Achronim don't argue with the Rishonim. And nowadays, this will probably happen in the near future, the Rosh Yeshiva, whatever they're going to call them, they don't argue with the Achronim. There's one person. There are many people who have tried, by the way, and they end up heretics or whatever else they may be. There's only one person that I know of in Jewish history who has successfully said, nope, I'm not from this era. I'm a Rishon, and my opinion is as valid as any other Rishon. I understand this Gemara as well as anybody else, and my opinion is just as valid as any of theirs. Why am I not entitled to my opinion, just like the Ran, just like the Rashba, just like the Rimi Gash? I'm a Rishon too. Based on what? Not chronology, based on knowledge, personal opinion, and is valued as such. It is perfectly valid for someone who follows the positions of the Gra consistently to choose Vilna Gaon over Shulchan Aruch. Who does that? He's the only one to get away with it in all of Jewish history. And it is a consistent theme that began immediately with his students, who tried to convey to the world that even though he was writing in 18th century Vilna, he may as well have been writing in Germany in 1325. It's the same weight. Svi? That's a good point.
So well accepted by everybody, more so with Vera Gra, because he brings out everybody else's opinion. He doesn't try to necessarily
understand
exactly. He brings them up in the phone and everybody else in order to kind of collaborate, you know, what the thinking is. Based upon that.
To say it differently, the reason we follow the Mishnah Brura's opinion is because he doesn't think they're his own opinion.
Right.
The Mishnah Brura is deciding from all of the options in front of me, what should I pick, right? Do we understand them correctly? And do they coalesce with one another? And if they don't, what's the number one criticism of the Mishnah Brura for those who criticize it for its methodology? When he's not sure which one is right, he says, just do the stringent one. So that's not a policy, or is it? Right? That is the policy that defined halachic Judaism for the entire 20th century. I'm not knocking it, right? That's the Chafetz Chaim's decision. That's his prerogative. When you find discrepancies between the Mishnah Brura's style and the style of the Aruch HaShulchan, so what is it? So the Aruch HaShulchan says, yeah, that's not what people do, right? And if that's not what people do in my town, so that's not the halacha. And this verse, well, there's a shita like that. I found a shita. So we should be machmir for that shita. So the Mishnah Brura isn't doing what the Gra is doing. The Gra is saying, these opinions are wrong. I don't think you should follow them. Yeah.
That You're saying that the leaders of Yonah, that they don't argue, like Hana doesn't argue with the Kumbhakar's leader, Korah won't argue with the Hana, because they assume that they're closer to the original soul.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, I don't think you have to see it as a negative, right? Yerida Sodoros isn't something that we're ashamed of or upset about in any way. But what's amazing is that the Vilna Gaon is clearly and definitively an exception to that rule, because he saw himself that way and others saw him that way as well. And it is consistent. All his Talmidim, all those who respected him, all those who follow that tradition, prominently like the Chazon Ish, who said unabashedly, Vilna Gaon is an exception. And what I wanted to clarify, if I didn't say it before, I want to clarify this point and then we'll end. It's not just that the Vilna Gaon's opinions were so great that people treated them like a Rishon. The Vilna Gaon treated himself like a Rishon. The Vilna Gaon believed in primary texts. This is a very important and dangerous piece of the Vilna Gaon's decision-making. The Vilna Gaon decided this is my opinion. I don't know. Just speculating. I would speculate that the Vilna Gaon decided that certain things were worth reading and certain things were not worth reading. Certain things, meaning primary texts, needed to be understood and needed to be perfected. He was concerned that girsos were wrong, things that transmitted in the wrong fashion. That was what was most important. Everything else around it was just noise. It was just commentary. The Vilna Gaon isn't, I'm sorry to say it this way, wasting his time with the Magen Avraham. He doesn't need a Magen Avraham. He has all of Shas at his fingertips. He has every Mishnah. He has every Tosefta. He has every Brisa available to him. He'll make his own decision about what the Gemara means. In other words, he decided that he was going to live the life of a Rishon. This is the only thing that matters to me. Bavli, Yerushalmi, and a little bit of other stuff. If I understand the entire corpus of it, I'm entitled to an opinion. And therefore, he said, this is the opinion that I'm going to give. And as a result, you have to make one epic, halachic, historical decision. Is he allowed to do this? And the consensus, I know there's a few hands, I'm going to get to them in a second. The consensus is he was allowed to. Who else in Jewish history was allowed to say, I know Shas well enough to draw my own conclusion? And so the Talmidim and the Chazon Ish, and it has become universally accepted that the Vilna Gaon's decision to conduct himself like a Rishon was legitimate. And since it was legitimate, his right to argue with those who came before him is unquestioned. Okay, Rivka, Samson, and Donald. Rivka, go ahead. I believe so. Remember, the Vilna Gaon's positions kind of drip out very slowly because he doesn't have a platform in which he teaches. I think everyone who came in contact with him, I'll try and give an example in another session of some of the talk in Vilna about whether or not they should be funding this guy's life who never leaves his attic. But that is one extreme ridiculous story that kind of gives you the sense of how great of an individual he was. Largely speaking, I don't think he was ever challenged on his brilliance, and I don't think he was ever challenged on his piety. And as a result of the two, he doesn't get a lot of flack for something that was subtle, but very progressive and very radical of an idea, which is really quite astonishing. Yeah, Samson. Oh, sure. That's amazing. Okay, great. He stood for the beginning and sat for the brachos. Okay, we'll have to finish the Havdalah shir. Samson. Yeah. Yep.
That was also pushing towards what seemed like an extreme,
Yeah. Okay, so the challenge with the The challenge with the Ramchal is much more complicated. I would say the following, which is the Ramchal's, the Ramchal's writings were perceived as very dangerous while he was in his 20s. And he was asked not to write things that could be perceived as dangerous. And he said, no, I'll write them anyway. And the reaction or overreaction, which is subject to a lot of debate, was a result of that. By the time the Vilna Gaon's reputation was established, it was universally understood. Anybody who came in contact with him or heard about him or met someone who met him at some point in time understood that he was the Gadol HaDor. And that changes the equation entirely. Yeah, Donald, I want to make one last point.
I remember you saying last year around the time that he was an opponent of the Shulchan Aruch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Contemporary, 100 years before the Vilna Gaon, because, I think you just said this about the Vilna Gaon, he felt it was more important to look at the primary sources.
Correct. So that's great. So for those who were with us last year, we'll remember our discussion about the Maharal and his brother and their responses to the Shulchan Aruch, which are both very important. However, I think what we've seen tonight, and I believe this to be true, the Vilna Gaon did not agree with that position. His children asked him, why didn't you write your own code? And he said, Hashem didn't want me to. The generation wasn't worthy for it. Something like that. I don't think he was opposed to the code. I think he thought the code was flawed. Which just that assumption alone is a very different kind of assumption. That's my impression from everything that I've seen. Now, yeah, Jamie, last one, and then I'll wrap it up. I have no idea. My suspicion would be that My suspicion would be that Reb Chaim Volozhiner did too. And he just, this is the asterisk. Can't tell me I'm doing what the Gra said is wrong. I know the Gra better than you know the Gra. That's my instinct, but I don't know that for sure. I don't know if that's for sure, correct? It's only speculation. Okay, we have to wrap this up by saying the following. Is this good for Jewish history or bad for Jewish history? Because there was once upon a time, there was a guy who stepped outside the lines and we had to put him in excommunication. The Vilna Gaon broke the rules, or his Talmidim, maybe it's not his fault. His Talmidim broke the rules. So is that good or bad? So the question is, will we try to break the rules again, right? What Alan Nadler does in his article, I'll share it. By the way, I started a listserv last week. If I forgot you were here and I left your name off the list and you want to get the emails, email me after the shiur tonight so I can add you to the list. I'll share the article for everyone who wants to read it. Nadler shows you something remarkable, which is a perfect segue to week number 3. Which is the following. Who was the next person or next movement to say, my Rebbe was so great, he gets to break the rules of Jewish history and jump back in time? The Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov. Because I don't think we didn't do things like this. This isn't our nusach. This is not how we're supposed to daven. This is not the way we do mitzvos. This is not the kind of curriculum we're supposed to have in yeshivas. What is this chassidus business? This is not traditional Judaism, and they use the exact same language. They say, well, the Baal Shem Tov was different. There hasn't been anybody like the Baal Shem Tov for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Oh yeah. So the Ramah was a wonderful Talmud Chacham, but did he really understand Judaism? Not the way the Baal Shem Tov understood Judaism. And you read that language and you say to yourself, come on, that's ridiculous. You can't just get a get out of jail free card because you say your Rebbe's better than everybody else's. But who are they actually directly competing with? Students of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon students themselves open a very dangerous can of worms by saying our Rebbe gets to break the rules. And I think, we'll see if it's true next week, I think this was actually used against them. In the fights between the Misnagdim and the Hasidim started to break the rules. And the only way that they could overcome the fact that the Vilna Gaon rejected them, who they recognized as the Gadol Hador, the biggest Talmud Chacham, and the most pious person around, was that somebody else needed to break the rules like them in order to change Jewish history again. So this answers, at least from the perspective of Vilna Gaon's Talmidim, what really made him truly special. And like I said, it's once Jewish history, maybe twice, for better or for worse. Okay, we'll hold here. Thank you, everybody. And we will continue next time. I don't know if that email.